here, and I want to welcome to the studio E.R. Mason, who's going to be our main guest here for the show, because E.R. Mason is an author. He was also involved with the Kennedy Space Center, and he was a coordinator at the Space Center, just for about 25 years or so. And we're going to talk to him about, there are some really interesting things going on at the Space Center and some things going on which are coming out soon, some new projects at the Space Center that he's going to share with us. And also, he's also a writer and one of my favorite authors of science fiction, with the Adrian Tarn series and his other books that he's written with Cassiopeia and his other people in his books. And he's got another book coming out, which he's just about to finish. All right, so welcome to the studio, E.R. Mason, and you live over in the Space Coast, correct?
Yeah, I live over on the Space Coast after having retired from the Space Center.
Very good. All right, so let's start, back at the beginning. You were born, and then what happened?
Well, my basic life training was actually on a horse ranch in Connecticut. We trained horses, rodeos, horse shows, and I'll bet there's quite a few senior citizens out there who remember what it was like back in the 1950s. My brother and I spent a lot of time on tractors, cutting hay and baling it and throwing those 70-pound bales up in the loft. And in the winter, you shoveled the snow to the barn and carried buckets of hot water out there to melt the hand pumps so you could water the horses and unfreeze the grain in the barrels. And in those days, if you did not have enough heating oil and you got trapped in a snowstorm, there was a chance you didn't make it, and a few people did not back then. I'm sure a lot of seniors remember those days. Things have changed a bit.
Well, you know what? I want to interject. I lived in Connecticut for a while too, and I'm a lifelong New Englander. And people have the impression that a place like Connecticut, like they think of like Greenwich and the outskirts of New York City, and New London and New Haven, and along the coast. You can to central Connecticut, and it is still very rural. There are still big, wide open spaces, so I easily visualize, this horse farm. And while it sounds maybe incongruent that you talk about growing up on a horse farm in Connecticut, you see people growing up on a horse farm in like Montana or something. I hear you. And also too, I lived in Maine, and yes, the winters can be brutal, and that's why the neighbors are so close, because people can die if you're not properly prepared.
Indeed. Okay, so you're growing up, and now tell us a little bit about your education, and then we'll get into your writings.
I went to a wonderful high school. It was as large as many colleges. It's called the Norge Free Academy. And I had a particular English teacher there. Her name was Janice McIntyre, and she really was the one that drove me into writing. But as far as the sci-fi end of writing goes, I remember when I was 4 years old, I read I had my first book. It was Mickey Mouse's and his spaceship. And for some reason, I just thought that was the greatest thing ever, and it just stayed with me forever. Did some college in Connecticut and down here before going to the Space Center. That's what basically brought me to the world of writing.
All right, so when did you start writing? Were you writing while you were one of the coordinators at the Space Center, or did that come later after you retired?
Good story on that. I wrote my first screenplay when I was about 9 years old. It was called The Last Robbery. And my brother was my 5-year-old brother was the good guy sheriff, and I was the bad guy bank robber, and we actually filmed it in blazing 8mm. And the filming went really well until the last scene, when the good guy sheriff was supposed to outdraw me and shoot me down in the street, but for some reason his gun got stuck in the holster. And so I had to slow my draw down to make sure he won, and it ended up being the longest, slowest, fast gun ever filmed.
Do you still have that?
We do still have that somewhere.
That sounds like that would be a gas to see. So that's sort of why you did science fiction. Mickey Mouse sort of inspired you?
That and my first movie was Forbidden Planet at 5 years old. And I just thought that was the greatest thing also. So I had a lot of science fiction airplane exposure back then, even though we were on the ranch.
Yeah. All right, so now you're writing. getting to do some writing, yes?
Yeah, and it's a story many writers will tell you. I actually finished my first novel on a Commodore 64, and I sent it in for publication, and I had two banners on the wall in my office. One was rejection section, and the other wall was affection section. The rejection section wall was always full.
Sure.
So I got an editor, and I took this first novel, The Empty Door, back and forth with the editor. And then I made some bound galleys, which are promo books with just a plain white cover, and mailed these bound galleys to a bunch of bookstores around the country. Got a lot of good reviews, so then I thought I was ready. So I sent the manuscript back out with all the good reviews, and to this day I still have that second set of rejection letters. So it was never, never did get a break from the industry.
So these were basic publishers that you sent it to?
Literary agencies and publishers,
Yeah.
Many years later, when the internet started up, I finally had a chance to publish it myself. And I thought I'll publish The Empty Door, and if I'm lucky, maybe over 2 or 3 months I can get 20 or 30 people to read this thing. And I put it on the web one night and got up in the morning, and there had been 100 downloads. So I fell out of my chair and continued on from there.
And this was free, right? You were not charging for this, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, so before we go any further, we're not allowed to mention any particular costs for things, but generally you don't charge for your e-books, correct?
Well, my first six novels I turned out for free just to help build a reader base and to do something nice for the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's nothing like good stories. I've always been a big sci-fi fan. You know, I'm curious now. Who do you read? Who do you like?
John D. McDonald is really my number one author. I read pretty much everything he's done. He's not with us anymore, of course. But
well, he was pretty prolific. He had quite a catalog. John McDonald books are great.
Yeah, so mainly him. I've tried for Steve King and some of the others like that, mainly John D. McDonald is the name I would name.
Kind of stuff.
John D. McDonald does mystery stuff, and it's got a Florida thing to it, you know, right?
Yeah, it's based in Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
His Travis McGee series.
There you go.
Lives on a houseboat, and he won in a poker game.
Right.
So, yeah. That's
yeah.
Pretty good.
And one thing I comment with your books is very fast pace. Each page, just edge of the seat. Next page, edge of your seat. There's very little kind of downtime or places to catch your breath in your science fiction writing. Everything is really fast paced. If you like that kind of stuff, then those are the that's what I recommend. All right, so we're talking about sort of your first break here. So what was sort of your first break?
Well, that was what I mentioned here a moment ago is. I finally published it myself, and overnight had hundreds of downloads as I kept publishing. So it wasn't ever the literary agencies or the industry that ever gave me a break. It was actually the Readers of America. That's a nice way to get a break.
All right, so where does your material come from? And we can talk about some of the specifics for some of your books. Like, did you grow up in Tibet? I guess I should ask you that, because some of your characters, at least Adrian, has some experience with growing up in Tibet, correct?
I'm glad to get that question. It's very interesting, and I'll bet it's something both Steve and Lou, I bet you both experienced it. When I was around 7... I was standing out in a field looking at the trees and the skies, and I suddenly realized there was a lot more going on around us than we really knew about. So I started studying every mystery I could find, mythology, the major religions, biblical archaeology, spacecraft data, Sumerians, the Mayans, Atlantis, UFOs, all of that stuff. And it's interesting, when you pursue those kind of mysteries, there's so many false leads that can take you in the wrong direction. But at the end of it, somehow I managed to find the real thread of truth, and I followed it to an end. And from studying all those mysteries, I now have enough material to last me forever, basically. That's where it comes from. And yeah, would you like to know where that thread of truth led to?
Yeah, I would. Please. I would be wondering. Yes, I was.
What I found was all of those mysteries we see here in life: the angels, UFOs, miracles, the face on Mars, ghosts, life after life. They're all connected, and the tapestry that they weave together is so profound it would take you a lifetime just to outline it. But you can. There is an answer. There is a summary to it all. It may be, may not be what you're expecting, but it's this. It's we visit the earth to recognize our shortcomings and to work to better ourselves. The visit's kept short because it's so tough here. And when we withdraw from this visit back to our greater life and we look back, the only things that are important to us are how we treated others and whether or not we made the world a more pleasant place wherever we went. That is the ultimate answer to all of these mysteries and secrets we see.
I think another way I've heard it all, a shorter way, is sort of kindness is the only thing that matters.
Right.
Yes, that's sort of another way. But you're, one of the themes throughout your books is, well, alien life. And also, you also sort of give evidence that aliens have been around for a while and that there's limited contact and limited revealing of themselves to us. And that's sort of a theme there. And that is that something you've thought about?
If Star Trek probably put it the best, non-interference tenet. You know, life. This mm-hmm. life is so complex, it really didn't occur by accident. And the effort is to preserve it the way it is for the experience that we're having. If you're wondering why you're here, think of how much you knew when you were 13 or 14. That's the age when you finally decide you know everything and you just have to teach it to your parents. But if you think of what you knew when you were 13 or 14 and what you know now, that's why you're here.
All right, we're listening to E.R. Mason, Ed Mason, and he's an author. He's also a musician. He's also a coordinator at the Space Center for many years. This is WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. We're your true community radio station here in Sarasota, Florida. And this is your news and public affairs show, Surreal News. And we're so glad to have E.R. Mason here in the studio. All right, for those of us that are, let's say, would-be authors, and we're trying to figure out what are we going to do, how are we going to break into, let's say we have a manuscript. What would you say? How would you advise us?
Yeah, this is important information if you're getting ready to publish or you've been wanting to publish. There are two main outlets, www.smashwords.com. And the second one is kdpamazon.com. If you listeners who are interested want to grab a writing, something to write with, I'll repeat those and spell them in a moment here. Both Smashwords and Amazon are free. They don't cost you anything. Smashwords will distribute your work to places like Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Apple, and a lot of others. Amazon has subsidies all over the world also, and they distribute to those. Amazon offers you two ways. You can publish with them exclusively and get a higher royalty, or you can publish with anyone you want and get half of that royalty. These two distribution centers will give you access to a very large worldwide reader base.
And these are basically e-books, right?
Yes, these are e-books. You can evolve into hardback. They're offering, they have programs they offer now to put you in print. It's a little expensive, though.
Yeah. With some of these, for example, with Smashwords, you can publish for free. You can offer your manuscripts for free. You can also charge for them. You can't say, by the way, just don't say what the charge is, but you do have an option also of trying to sell your manuscripts as well, correct?
Right. You can sell on both Smashwords and Amazon. You cannot give your book away for free on Amazon, except under special circumstances. But on Smashwords and both Amazon, you can sell your book, and I'll give you the royalties here in a second. Well, in fact, why don't I do that? Royalties on Smashwords are a little bit complex. The author receives 85% of the list price of his book when they're sold directly on the Smashwords site. Books sold by Smashwords direct affiliates around the world, they will pay you 70.5% of the list price of your book. And for retailers like Barnes & Noble who have an agreement with Smashwords, you get 60% of the list price of your book. There's also some small processing fees, but they're really not significant. That's Smashwords. With Amazon, if you agree to publish exclusively with them, you get 70% of your list price. And if you will not go exclusively, you get 35%, half of that. And you should keep in mind that going with a traditional publisher, they typically pay their authors 10 to 15% on hardcovers and 1 to 10% or average of 6% on paperback. So obviously your royalties from self-publishing are much higher. And let me repeat those websites for anybody who wants them. It's www.smashwords.com, S-M-A-S-H-W-O-R-D-S, one word, Smashwords, just like it sounds. And Amazon is kdp.amazon.com, K as in kilo, D as in delta, P as in papa, .amazon.com. There's no www on that address.
All right, so how does that compare to, let's say, a literary agent?
You know, what I wanted to say about literary agents, a lot of people are probably going to gasp, but a literary agent basically is supposed to walk around and try to sell your book and help you advertise it. But my own personal opinion is, unless you have some kind of national exposure or some other special circumstance, I would not waste my time searching for a literary agent to represent me. I recently read that many agencies get 500 queries, requests for representation a week. And so if you do the math, 500 queries a week would be someone reading and replying to one query every 5 minutes, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. So you are most likely going to get an automatic email response to your query, and you're going to think your work wasn't good enough when that's not the case. So what are the chances they're really going to consider your query? The chances are they won't even open it. Imagine your email title buried in 100 other email titles. It only takes a second to get that, quote, "this is not the right project for us," unquote. I'm sure a lot of you have already heard.
Right.
A last thing is, if you you do get an agency, you're going to sign a contract giving them 10 to 20% of your book's profits. But in that contract, they're not going to guarantee what they will be doing for you. Last but not least, there are some literary agencies which are just not legitimate. They will ask you for money up front to represent you. I would not go with them ever.
All right. Interesting. And I guess just from what you're saying, generally, your experience with Smashwords has been good, has been positive, correct?
Yeah. I've had my problems, and I'm glad you worded the question that way, Steve, because there is a one thing you need to really be wary of, and that is if you publish your book for free, any mischievous youth or any person who is angry can go in and write a terrible, nasty review about you and your book, and they don't have to have read a page of it. If your book is for sale, on the other hand, they will have to pay the sale price in order to go in and write that review. And generally, people who write those terrible, nasty reviews won't pay money to do it. And if you do get a terrible review, Smashwords or Amazon will not remove it, no matter how hard you plead, even if there's four-letter words used in the review.
Wow.
Yeah. When the problem is, if you publish for free, you're guaranteed to get many more people looking at your work. When people come across your book and it's free, they're much more likely to try a few pages to see if they like it. The only thing is, you have to be prepared to get bad reviews no matter what you do. I checked on Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea a little while ago, and his book had 131 or 2 star reviews, and most of the reviews said the book was poorly written or boring.
Okay.
So you're going to get something, some bad reviews no matter what you do. It's like Adrian Monk always said, it's a jungle out there.
Well, you know, also too, just interject, talking about Hemingway, one of his you know, colleagues or compatriots there, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby was not well received at all, and now a lot of people consider it perhaps the great American novel, and there are a lot of people that, you know, thought that it was just, you know, it was pretty crappy. literally didn't like it.
What a perfect example.
Yeah.
All right. Now, what I thought we'd do is switch to your music career a little bit, and then we're going to talk about the space program. We're going to go there, and hopefully we'll get to the Shroud of Turin. Let's play a little bit. Let's do Love Letter this time, a little bit in the background while we're talking. So here's another composition by E.R. Mason. He's our guest in the studio. He's an author. He's a musician. He was a coordinator for the Space Center as well. And you're listening to this particular song is dedicated to the U.S. military personnel who are away from home, called Love Letter. And just while I have you on the air, just say you give us permission, royalty-free, to play this, because I'm supposed to ask you that.
Please play it as often as much as you can.
All right, thank you. Okay, so tell us a little bit, how did you get involved with music as a career, too?
Oh, yeah, that's kind of humorous story. My parents on the ranch did not believe music was of any importance, so they would not get me an instrument, even though I wanted one. I had a harmonica. That was pretty good. But finally, a friend of mine found a trumpet in the dump and gave it to me. Unfortunately, the previous owner had been lubricating the valves by spitting on them. And to make matters worse, he chewed tobacco. But it was the best thing that could have happened, because I drove my parents so batty that they let me take lessons. And a short time later, my best friend Bill Larson showed up with an electric guitar, and I had one I could borrow. So we started learning Ventures, Pipeline, Walk Don't Run, that stuff. Not long after, the Beatles came out, and that was it. We were hooked, and to this day, I still joke with Bill that he ruined my life.
All right, here's, again, a little bit of Love Letter. All right, so one of your songs that you've written, I've gotten a little bit of acclaim to it, and that's the Space Shuttle Aurora, right? That's your most popular one, correct?
Yeah, I would say that's been the most successful. And that was when the shuttle program ended. It affected us a lot more than most of us thought it would. We felt like something needed to be done to help remember how much of a sacrifice the companies and NASA had made to make that program work. And you have to remember that the shuttle program people gave us a space station, which is, how fantastic is that? So from that came the Space Shuttle Aurora.
And your site and your band is Free Fall Music. Is that the name of the band?
Yes, Stormy Harper, the bass player and my co-producer, he came up with the name Free Fall. It's a humorous reference to the fact that we were all over 40, and we added the second name America, to make it Free Fall America, to separate us from all the free fall bands around the world, and because we're proud of where we're from.
All right, so tell us a little bit about your CDs and where people can go if they want to hear again. There's no charge for this music, correct?
Yeah. If you go to www.freefallamerica.com, one word, Free Fall America, all of the Free Fall America music can be downloaded for free, everything you hear. And we're adding to it continuously.
All right, so tell us a little bit about Long Way Home and what's the concept behind that.
It's very interesting. When Stormy Harper and I got together to begin co-producing this, I had been working with John Black, our drummer. He and I had been working together for more than 30 years, and we had been working with a gifted keyboardist and arranger and songwriter by the name of Mitch Godwin. The song that's playing in the background, you hear all these pretty keyboards in the background, that's the genius of Mitch Godwin in there. And we had all loved the Beatles and Pink Floyd because their music was about life. The Wall, Comfortably Numb, A Day in the Life, Eleanor Rigby. So we wanted to produce a concept album that was about the journey through life we're all making, the prodigal son, if you will, and that is what you have in the CD Long Way Home.
Very nice. Still producing music?
Yep.
What's the next thing coming out?
We're working on a song called Undertaker.
Ooh.
It's got about a 6-minute John Black drum solo in it.
All right, what's your next book coming out?
Next book is Demon's Well, which is looks like a horror story, but it's actually a science fiction disguised as a spooky house story.
Oh, just in time for Halloween, huh? Okay. Are you finished it yet?
Yeah, it's in the editing process.
Done?
Yeah, done, but in the editing process, and you never know how long that takes.
Gotcha. All right, so while we're here also, just mention, I don't have in front of me a list of all your books, but go ahead and tell us, start with your first series and then go through the books that you have. You started, when did you write your first one?
1980s was the first one I published, yeah.
And that was The Empty Door?
That was The Empty Door, and the sequel to The Empty Door was The Virtual Dead. The sequel to The Virtual Dead was The Glass Hummingbird, and after The Glass Hummingbird was The Aurora City. I'm amazed I'm getting through all these.
Yes, and this was Cassiopeia and The Professor, that series.
Right.
Right?
Right, it's a bit spiritual, that
ended series. With The Aurora City. That was the last one.
Yeah, the next one is The Threatening Sky, coming after The Aurora City.
Oh,
it's not written yet.
Oh, there's another one. Okay.
Yeah.
We can see what's going to go on next.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, and then Adrian Tarn came into existence,
right?
Correct?
The Adrian Tarn started with Fatal Boarding and then went to Deep Crossing, and then on to Shock Diamonds. And the one I'm working on, the next one, which is Dark Vengeance.
So the Griffin is coming back? There's going to be a fourth in that?
Yep.
That would be the fourth.
Yep,
you weren't sure if the Griffin is going to go back out into space again. Is what it is, you say?
Yep.
Okay. But the one you're working on now is not in that series. It's a different...
Right.
You're going a different direction now.
Standalone. You have to.
Any teasers to what we can expect here
from
our fans?
From the standalone?
From the standalone, yeah.
Well,
where are you going here?
By telling you it's a horror, a spooky house disguised as science fiction. I mean, science fiction disguised as a spooky house. I've already said too much.
There you go. All right, well, let's go into space now and talk a little bit about your experience. What is a coordinator at the Space Center, and what did you do when you were there?
Coordinator's actually like a supervisor who supervises a project and employees working on it. And the environment at the Kennedy Space Center and its counterpart, the Eastern Range, it's really unlike anywhere else you would work. You know, there's we refer to it affectionately as the Rocket Ranch, and it's a government installation, but it's manned almost entirely by private companies and corporations that have been contracted by NASA. And these private companies and corporations do just about all of the work. And you drive around there and you're surrounded by launch towers, giant transport equipment, checkout buildings, rocket stages. But on the indoors, it's an entirely different environment. You're immersed in corporate and government politics to a great degree, along with, of course, due dates and cost schedules and those kind of problems. The stress level is pretty high there, partly because of the kind of work that's being done. But there's one thing I wanted to put in here, wanted to add. It's every day we see examples of divisiveness and cultural differences in the news, and it gives the impression we're a country divided. But in my years at the Space Center, the corporations and companies that are building these next generation spaceships for us, they employ people of just about every race, culture, and religion in America. And 7 days a week, hundreds of thousands of us are working side by side, hand in hand, to take the U.S. into the future. That is the real truth of what's happening every day in America, not the senseless, amplified violence you see on the news.
Well, that's good to hear, because we certainly report about a lot of the other stuff, about a lot of the derisive stuff that seems to be clogging up our government and making people talk about us and them instead of just being kind and the things that really matter, which is where we should all be, I think. Okay, and what you write about and what I try to get to, too, in my volunteer work, including here at the radio station and personally, too. So, yeah, great. So there is a place. Let's all live at the Space Center and be kind and come together and stop worrying about all our differences and be together. Oh, I like that idea. All right, so give us a taste of the new engines and new rockets and new things coming down. All right, be as technical as you like here.
Okay. It's really, there is a wonderful future right around the corner. We can't see it because there's so much turmoil going on. But it's like people used to say that at the end of the Mayan calendar, that was going to mark the beginning of a new age. And the truth is, that may not be so far off. I mean, right now, there's no less than 4 or 5 new manned spacecraft designs that are almost mature and getting ready to head to the launch pad. The Orion capsule launches December 4th, and it's going to go higher and farther than we've been to since Apollo. And when the first of these spacecraft starts carrying U.S. astronauts into space, the U.S. will almost seemingly overnight have regained its role as the world leader in manned spaceflight. We'll be flying spacecraft like no one has ever seen before. If you remember all the switches and dials in the Apollo capsules and the Soyuz capsules, these new ships are controlled by touch screens, just like your tablet or your touch computer. And so the point is, if we can just get through this social and geological, I guess, upheavals that are going on, there's this fantastic science fiction future just around the corner waiting to become science fact. We need to get there.
All right, so some of my personal way of experience is through simulators and through games, and I've always been a gamer, a video gamer kind of thing, and my understanding that the original flight simulators, which then became games, were just that. They were originally designed to train pilots. All right, so walk us through sort of the history and anything you want to tell us about flight simulators, which fascinates me.
They were using a lot of flight simulators even before World War II. But in World War II, there were a wide variety of them. They had flight simulators for the bombardiers and navigators and, of course, the pilots. So, and back then they were pretty much mechanical devices. But what we have nowadays are just spectacular. Inspired to say is if you want to have a simulator at home, an aircraft simulator, you can get an aircraft simulator that's so good if you learned how to fly well on it, you could fly a real airplane. And there's a lot of pilots out there cursing me probably right now, but the truth is Flight Simulator X, for example, by Microsoft, the gauges and dials on the airplanes they offer you are exactly as they are in the cockpit. And if you learn to hold that airspeed that you need and line up with that runway, keep the runway numbers in the bottom of the windshield, and learn to land that thing, if you get in a real airplane, you're going to feel very much at home.
Have you tried both? Have you tried a real airplane and a simulator, basically simulating the same thing?
Yeah. In fact, I have a good simulator at home, Flight Simulator X. And you know, you have to go for your biannual review every 2 years. Now that I'm in the 60s, it's every year. And so before I would go for my biannual review, I get sit down at the simulator and go through all the stalls and everything right on the simulator so that when I get in the airplane, I'm really fresh for what we're about to do.
What's your favorite aircraft to fly?
There's a simulator, if you're really interested in simulators, there's a simulation for Flight Simulator X. It's the Boeing 747-400. And it has every single knob and dial and system in the airplane. It's there on your computer screen working. Even the flight management computers where you type in your headings and flight plan, even the flight management computers work in it. So that is my personal favorite. I've crashed that a lot of times.
Speaking of crashing things, so one of your books that you have, the aircraft, the Griffin, which is an aircraft which was originally made here on the planet Earth and then was modified by aliens in one of your Adrian Tarn books. Most of that novel is written as a simulation, getting it ready to go. And I think it's really interesting because a lot of our science fiction works have to do with what goes on out there in space. Not this one. This one, most of the book is about the simulation. And I highly recommend it if you want to sort of simulate a simulator of an advanced type of aircraft and to read that one. The other thing I think was interesting about that one, which reminded me of Star Trek, was that there was a scene in there where they intentionally set up a simulation that was supposed to crash to stress out the pilots, and then you had your woman pilot, I forgot her name, who then figured out how to defeat the broken simulation, right? Yeah. So tell us about that a little bit.
That particular episode that you're referring to is actually a true story.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I have a close friend who's I'll say Learjet. Learjet is the has become a global term now, but he's a Learjet private jet pilot, and he was checking out in the simulator to get his certifications, which they have to do like every 6 months. And they programmed in a failure on him that they thought could not be surmounted. And he actually did what you see in my book there. He cycled the engines using the auxiliary power unit. He made the main engine spin using the auxiliary power unit. That's the device you use to start the engines.
Right.
So he got them to spin, and he got enough thrust out of those dead engines just spinning the turbines that he made it to the runway and landed, and upset the programmers because they had planned on him crashing to teach him a lesson.
Okay.
That is cool. Well, we are just about out of time. E.R. Mason, Ed Mason, is in the studio. We were going to get to the Shroud of Turin, which I think is very interesting. I don't think we're going to get to it. Maybe you'll have to come back and tell us about that.